What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
It was successful right out of the gate. The customers come and tell you, hey, this is like I remember from back home. Like finally a place that looks like what I was used to from where I grew up. And by the time we opened, 7-8 months later, the recession was in full force and it was 50% vacant. One of Costco's buyers lived by one of our stores and he was a customer. And then they were looking for more Mexican products, Hispanic products. And so he reached out, hey, I like your stores. I like your products. Would you consider selling these to Costco?
In a 2005 Los Angeles Times article titled A New World of Panaderias, journalist Barbara Hansen remarks on the best Latino bakeries in L.A. She mentions fruit-filled empanadas and gushes over pan de yema, a traditional Oaxacan egg bread. But she says little about the actual panaderias, the physical bakeries. Ricardo Cervantes and Alfredo Olivas wanted to change that. When the two Mexican immigrants moved to L.A. following their graduation from Stanford's business school, they decided to build a different type of Mexican bakery, one that made you want to buy flaky puff pastries and eat them there. They wanted to turn the Mexican panaderia into an experience. So they reached out to family and friends, raised money, and opened the first La Monarca Bakery. Today, the Bright Orange Bakery and Cafe has 12 locations across Los Angeles, is in Costco stores all over the Southwest, and is in World Market locations nationwide. Ricardo Cervantes joins Business School to tell us why he left a successful career in accounting for one of Mexico's biggest firms to start over in the United States, why people told him it was a bad idea to make a bakery for Latinos, and why he wants La Monarca to be a business that does well and good for the community. Plus, he answers questions from business owners around the country. I'm journalist Fernando Hurtado, and on Business School, I'm on a mission to map one of the fastest growing groups of entrepreneurs in the United States, Latinos. We're tracking how they got started, found success, and the most important lessons they've learned along the way. And remember, business school is expensive. Business school is free. All right, welcome to Business School, Ricardo. How are you?
Very good, Fernando. Thank you for having me.
Ricardo, I have to thank you because this is an excuse for me personally, to talk about pan dulce for 45 minutes, and I've never had permission to do that. And this is the first time it's socially acceptable to do that, for me at least.
Happy to help.
And I think it's helpful to start with some definitions for people who may not be familiar with the term pan dulce. What does it mean?
Sweet bread, very literally. And that does have an implication with, it's not a pastry, It's sweet bread. So it has less, or it should have, less sugar. It's a little bit softer. It has not too many calories, or not as many. And so it's a very traditional, not even dessert, food in Mexico specifically, but also in Latin America.
You know what's funny? I didn't know that, and I need to apologize because I've been using pastries and pan dulce interchangeably, but your definition makes a lot of sense, and I trust that you know more than I do about sweet bread. And I have to ask you this, like, what is your go-to or your favorite pan dulce?
I personally like orejas. I don't know if you like those or you know which ones. The palmiers, yeah. So I really like those. And, of course, who doesn't like a good concha, no? The one that looks like a seashell.
And you grew up in Monterrey, Mexico.
Yes.
And you are probably the third founder I've spoken to recently who is from Monterrey. So I also have to ask you, what's in the pan dulce in Monterrey that's making everyone so successful there?
Well, no, Monterrey is a historically business center of Mexico. So there's a lot of heavy industry and, you know, from cement, glass, steel. Mm-hmm. And so growing up there, that was kind of the culture that is entrepreneurial and, you met and learned about different people that started companies that then became emblematic, some of the city and even of Mexico. So maybe that's it.
Yeah, it's a rapidly growing city too, and industry hotspot, right?
Yes.
So you grow up there, and then you decide to go to business school, not business school, actual business school, in California. Why do you decide to do that, and why Stanford of all schools? I'm kidding. Great school. Why Stanford?
I was working. I had graduated. It'd been almost 4 years since I graduated from college and was working in one of the big companies there in finance. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do a transition to more of marketing. Mm-hmm. And kind of entrepreneurship, if you will. And of course, Stanford, very renowned university for both. And so I figured, okay, I can apply. You don't know if you're going to get mm-hmm. in, but I might as well. And I was fortunate enough to get in. But it was really that, the idea of not necessarily starting my own business, but kind of get into a school that would teach me more entrepreneurship. And again, more on the marketing side of things as well. So that was the general idea.
So you're in business school, a great program. And in business school, you also meet someone who will become very crucial to the story of La Monarca, and that's Alfredo Olivas. Do you remember how you met, who will later become your co-founder?
Sure. No, we met, say, first couple days of the program. It was actually, there were 15, I think, of us from Mexico.
Okay.
We're the second largest country represented in the business school that year. And so we all got together, all 15, to kind of meet each other. And that's where I met Alfredo. And so, interestingly enough, we're both from Monterey, but because Alfredo's 2 years younger than I am, we really never had crossed paths in Monterey. So interesting, funny that we never met until that day in business school. But so, yeah, I mean, we just became friends. And over the course of the next 2 years, you know, we probably had a few classes together, but then became roommates the second year with a couple other friends. And so we got to know each other more, especially that second year, I think.
Okay. So you said you went to business school because you kind of wanted to transition careers. What was your plan, and what did you think you were going to get out of business school?
Sure. No, the marketing side had always interested me. Mm-hmm. I was working in finance. I started accounting my undergrad. Mm-hmm. And that was good because accounting gives you kind of a view of how business runs, keeps score. Uh-huh. And so I was working in this conglomerate where they had about 25, 30 different companies in chemicals, textiles, packaging, environmental plants. So the companies that interested me more were always kind of the consumer products ones. So they had one that made sweaters and one that the biggest salt, literally salt brand in Mexico, they owned that. And then they had another one that did, the audience will remember this maybe, the Colcha San Marcos.
Oh, wow.
So they own that.
Wait, you got to stop that. I've never met anyone who's like responsible for that. They're such a cultural icon.
No, I was not responsible, but company, I worked in that company.
And that's
so
cool. Okay.
Those were, and they also had businesses that made chemicals and, you know, chlorine and all that. But so I always gravitated towards the more branded product businesses. Yeah. So that's where I said, okay, I think I would rather do more on the marketing business side, and I need to learn more about that.
And then after Stanford, you moved to Los Angeles.
Yes, but right before graduating, so Alfredo was doing, I was doing finance, but more on the corporate setting. Okay. He was doing finance at Morgan Stanley.
Okay.
And so he had an offer to go back to Morgan Stanley, and I had offered to do advertising, marketing in Los Angeles. Uh-huh. And so it was about a month or a couple months, let's say maximum a couple months before graduating. And we both ended up one afternoon in the living room of this house we lived in. And we were talking what your plans are, what my plans are. And then all of a sudden it's like, you know what? But it was just a conversation. Uh-huh. You know, the best classes or the most inspirational were the entrepreneurship classes. And you know what? I'm maybe he mentioned or I mentioned, but like we both said it, like I'm thinking instead of just taking the offer, going and trying to figure out a business. And so it was mutual,
okay,
without the idea, without knowing what kind of business. But so we both kind of say, are you serious or is this just, we're just kind of talking here? He says, no, I would do it. So then we kind of, okay, let's dig in and see what that would look like and how much time do we have? Do we want to dedicate after graduating and to figure out again, first the idea and then to see if we could do it.
And was the plan, we'll still keep working our jobs or we won't even go to those jobs and just start thinking about this idea?
Right. Initially, it was going to look more like we could do this maybe part-time. Uh-huh. And then as we started looking at what that would entail and talking to especially one of the professors there, he's like, you know, it's one of those things where you have to burn the ships. Mm-hmm. No, you have to jump all in. Mm-hmm. And we figured, okay, how long would we be able to survive on our savings that we have? And we both concluded we had about a year to dedicate full time. And so that's what we shook hands and said, okay, we'll do this for a year and hopefully we find an idea.
Okay, so you have
going.
The courage.
Yes.
You have the determination. You don't quite have an idea until you do. So how does the idea for Sweetbread and to do something in the Sweetbread space come about?
Right. So we both were interested in something having to do with Mexico. And of course, the U.S. Hispanic market, but specifically towards the Mexican population, because we're Mexican, so that's what we know. And then food had always interested us, but from a let's say, retail perspective, not just the food, because you could do food and have a factory and just sell to other businesses. But we wanted to do the selling directly. We wanted to have kind of retail. And just as doing kind of research, and we looked at grocery stores, we looked at savory food, and all of a sudden, just shopping even for ourselves, we noticed there was an opportunity because there was pan dulce, but really it didn't taste like what we were used to from back home. And so as we're looking at these businesses, all of a sudden, well, maybe this bakery business could be interesting. And that kind of, it took us about, remembering, maybe 3 months from where we were looking at different ideas. And then all of a sudden, you know what? This bakery thing might be interesting. And then we started doing a little bit more research. How does that look like in Mexico? There's big bakery chains. And who do we know in that industry that we could talk to see what does that look like? And so it took us another maybe 3 months. So at that time, then we still spent 3 months in the Bay Area, got the idea, and then we figured, okay, where is the bulk of the Mexican population in the U.S.? It's in L.A., so let's go over there.
Okay.
So that's why we moved to L.A. Again, we're still in the street. We're looking at what bakeries are here, what supermarkets sell, what big stores sell, what little stores sell. And so trying to find what the essence of our idea would be.
And what did you find your differentiator could be? Because there are so many panaderias in L.A. You know, I think you go to certain neighborhoods and you might even find more than one. And other neighborhoods too in the United States. So when you're thinking about this idea for La Monarca, what was your pitch at the time?
We, and it's Alfredo and I, after hitting the pavement for weeks, we noticed this is now 18 years ago. Well, actually 20 years ago when we're doing the research, as we graduated in 03. So, and so we're looking at the different neighborhoods. We're driving there. We're looking what Main Street in those areas looks like. And there was a lot of activity. Of course, as we all know, the Hispanic neighborhoods are working class and people are early morning. They're on the bike. They're on the bus. They're coming and going. And yet there was not a lot of investment at that time from like big branded kind of concepts and typical franchises. I won't name names, but then when we started talking to people that were in those companies, like, well, you know, it's more kind of, it doesn't meet our threshold of investment to do that in those neighborhoods. And we kind of have to say, we kind of took it a little personal because I'm like, okay, why wouldn't you invest in these neighborhoods? I'm seeing there's people here, it's busy. But so that was the mentality at the time. So it quickly became, this is not just going to be for the bread, for the pan dulce. This is going to be a place that hopefully is aspirational, that we're going to bring this investment in the community and to create opportunities as well, no? Mm-hmm. To bring people in, hire local, and then this gathering place that becomes kind of a patch of color in a sea of gray,
if you will.
So that was kind of the idea. And we didn't have the name yet.
Okay.
So we knew bakery and we knew retail, and then we saw that opportunity to do a place that was, again, on a little bit more colorful, but on the aspirational side, and then we didn't have a name for it.
And so, how do you come to La Monarca?
It was serendipitous, but at the same time, yes, aspirational, but then as the story and how do people come here and survive, and so it was about perseverance, and so we had all these connotations that we wanted to like embody, you know, like the resilience of the Mexican people and how hardworking and always family, and so it's about that, you know, perseverance, and all of a sudden looking at different icons, I was looking at different icons from Mexico and. For a couple days, and then on the third day, I see a photo of a monarch butterfly. It was like, that's it. Uh-huh. Like, the story of the butterfly, to me, embodied perfectly what all those characteristics of our people were. You know? So
yeah. So you have an idea, this great idea. You have a brand name, maybe you even have a logo at this point. But, of course, people can't buy orejas or conchas from an idea. You have to actually open a bakery. So how do you go about opening your first location? And what year are we talking about now, 2006?
So we opened the first store in 2006, Valentine's Day.
Okay.
Literally, that was the grand opening. But it took about a year.
Okay.
You go back. And so the whole process took 2 years, from idea to then writing the business plan, because we wrote a business plan, not just to check the box, but because a business plan really sets what you need to operate. It's not just an exercise for a class. It's really, okay, how much money are you going to need? What do you need equipment-wise? How does the real estate look like? How many people? Where are you going to source the ingredients? Where are the main suppliers? So you start putting that together.
It sounds like a lot of money.
It could be. But at the same time, it was then, okay, where do we want our first store geographically? And of course, again, we wanted to invest in Hispanic neighborhoods, hopefully very Mexican neighborhood. And so that's where driving around, we Huntington Park, and we're looking at the data, how many people live in. So Huntington Park fit that population-wise, and so demographically. And so we figured, okay, this is going to be like in Mexico. You just walk in and sign a lease. And signing a lease in the United States is much, much longer process, and they ask for many, many more things. So then that takes time. And then, oh, sure, once that's done, we'll just bring the mixers and start. And then guess what? There's a permitting process, and the build-out takes how many months it does, and city permits and county permits and all of that fun stuff. And so it literally took, between signing the lease and then opening, it was almost 7 months, 6-7 months.
And
for the build-out, no?
And your big product here, too, is not just, you know, I don't want to say just making coffee, but you're also making baked goods.
Yes.
So who is making these baked goods and who's deciding what they taste like?
Right. No. So hiring bakers and bringing in people, now not just for the pan dulce, but we want to make cakes. I want to make cookies. And so it's different skill sets, the cake decorators. And so, yes, it took a while to, you know, hire. And you literally start with a sign, now hiring. Bakers, cake decorators, and so that's how we started that. And initially, we also brought a chef from Mexico to help us set up. He was a French national that worked in Mexico for some years. And so we hired him to come and set up the first kitchen and the first teams. So, no, it's true. It wasn't an idea with many moving parts. It seems simple, the bakery, like you say, but then it's the product, but then the environment and the store. And how are you going to your point, differentiate from the other bakeries in the area? And it had to do with not just the ambience, but also how we started training our front of the house team.
Yeah.
Customer service, hospitality. Think like you're in Mexico welcoming a guest to your house. How does that look like?
To make it an experience.
It's an experience, exactly. It's not just you go buy a bread and leave. Uh-huh. It's the whole place.
What it makes you feel.
Yes.
And at the same time, though, you're also involved with a product and baked goods that have to taste good.
Yes.
So did you have experience before this in pastry, in knowing like, yes, this is a good pan dulce?
I had experience as a consumer, growing up, because those are things that the people living through it, we might take for granted.
Uh-huh.
But having grown up in Mexico my whole life and eating the food, at least you develop an understanding and the flavors, the palate to say this tastes good, this does not taste good, or this is missing this. I specifically have always liked to cook. I've never baked before, but I was always in the kitchen, and I liked mixing different things. And so when I try something, I can taste what's in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the main differentiator that we saw the opportunity in, as far as the product, we were talking about the experience of the place and the hospitality aspect. But most of the bakeries in the United States, and this is part of how the United States is the leader in business in the world, they are able to synthesize and mass produce things very quickly. Mm-hmm. No, that's over time history. And same was true for bread. Even though you would walk into this small bakery, when you saw how they were making the product, and it was literally they bought from these big ingredient companies the bag that said concha mix.
Oh.
And put that and put water, and then you have a concha. And it was at that moment when Alfredo and I said, now we get why everything it tastes kind of the same, and it doesn't taste like back home because we're used to making things from scratch. So to this day, we make everything from scratch. Our recipes are our own. We develop them and redevelop them over time. And they have very simple ingredients. We don't use any preservatives, nor artificial colors or flavors. And I specifically, because I had to redesign all the recipes over time, was very conscious of doing the exact proportions of, as they say, the big three, the salt, sugar, and fat contents on our products. So we use butter, we use sugar, we use salt, but in exact proportions, not too much.
Uh-huh.
If it has 55%, it's 55. It's not 58. It's not 52. And so enough to make the product taste as it should, hopefully really good, but nothing that then is excessive in calories or overly sweet.
Okay. And how does that first store in Huntington Park do?
Fortunately, it was successful right out of the gate, but more so because, again, we had hired locally from, that was part of the mission to create opportunities in the communities that we would serve. And so hiring local, and then those people, of course, tell the people that they know that live in the community. And we very quickly, the word of mouth kind of went around. And so it was a whole year of learning, because it's not like, we're successful immediately. It was busy from the get-go. But the bakery cycle, or the bakery business, it's very driven by holidays, no, in the year. Mm. So if you think, from January, you have the Rosca de Reyes. Uh-huh. And then you get Valentine.
Uh-huh.
And you get Easter. And you get Mother's Day. You get Father's Day.
You have all these memorized.
Right, no? But so you can see how you have to, or we, I say, Alfredo and I, quickly realized we have to go through the whole year to see how this movie actually plays out. Because, and I've told this to folks that open similar businesses in different parts of the calendar year, nothing is as, in, it's not going to be like that one point in time, whether for the good or the bad. Mm. If you open for Christmas, you think, oh, this is really busy all the time. But if you open in the middle of a heat wave in the summer, all of a sudden, oh, that looks very different. So, but you have to go through the whole year. And there's the bakery business. I like to say, no one walks angry into a bakery. No, you go to treat yourself for an indulgence, for a happy moment in your day. Yeah. So there's always, throughout the calendar, reasons to go. And that's one of the things that I like personally about it.
And right away off the bat, when you opened this store, were you so happy with the results that you said, all right, we're sticking with this? Or did you ever think, oh, man, maybe we got to shift a little?
No. So it was good from, I say, that first year. We learned a lot, made quite a few mistakes and learned from them. But overall, we saw it wasn't just that it was a good business, but both of us and I liked it as our purpose or our business calling. Because you could do many businesses in different industries. Yeah. And some people, they say, it's a job. Some people, to us, it wasn't like, it's not just that, yes, the store was okay and doing well, but we were really enjoying it. And again, seeing the customers come and tell you, hey, this is like I remember from back home, like finally a place that looks like what I was used to from where I grew up.
Yeah.
And then, of course, seeing team members that we hired as, you know, as a sanitation person, all of a sudden they're a shift leader. Because they're learning and they're liking it, and they're, you know, so creating those opportunities for the community. So that's rewarding, or that was rewarding for us. So we're on the right track, we thought, and so okay, let's keep going. But it took a good couple years to cement what that store, because some products you think are going to work, and they don't, and some products that you have no idea all of a sudden become very popular.
Yeah,
and so that's it. You learn as you go.
Right. So you opened in 2006, and then 2 years later, a recession hits. So I want to hear about how that impacted La Monarca and how you weathered that storm. But before we do that, I want other people to ask you questions. So we are going to hear a question from a design studio owner in California.
Hey, y'all. My name is China, and I'm the founder at Monforte Studio. Which position did you make as your first official employee, and how did you know you were ready?
Alfredo and I were the first official employees. So having met and being friends, we still needed to know each other to see if we were culturally first, complementary, and then skill set complementary.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yes.
You have, and we all have friends that were very good friends. But when you think about it, you're like, no, I would never work with them. No? So it's first about having cultural fit, and cultural not in the ethnicity part or no, but culturally meaning what's your outlook in life? What does success look like for you? What are your values? How did you grow up in your home? Mm-hmm. What was important to your family and to you? And so having that conversation, it really, for me and Alfredo, was the first step in seeing, okay, we can meet eye to eye here. Once that's a fit, then skill set-wise, what do you bring, what do I bring? If we both know exactly the same things, well, we're kind of, it's instead of having two people that both can take different loads, all of a sudden you're stuck. And so the question there, complementary skills. What don't you know that you need to have in somebody else? And that that they bring to the table.
Great, great answer. All right, next question. This next question is from a recipient of the Comcast Rise Award. So Comcast Rise supports the growth of all small businesses and individuals committed to their communities. And Rise has awarded more than $125 million in monetary, marketing, and technology grants to businesses all over the United States. So let's hear a question from a Rise recipient.
Hi, my name is Lizette Appy, and I'm owner and manager of Thunder Mug Cafe here in Philadelphia. When scaling up, how do I effectively divide my time between two locations?
Divide time between two locations. When we opened the second store, we had been running the first one for almost 3 years.
Okay.
So 2.5 years, almost 3 years. And so we had very purposely developed or started developing our team to take on the bigger responsibility at the first store. So you try to identify who does things well, and you always paint, you have to tell people what the end goal is for them. So when we hired, it was always, hey, we're looking to create opportunities for the people that we hire to grow with the company, to not just stay as a cashier. How about you become a shift leader, an assistant manager, a store manager? And so having done that over the first years at the first store enabled Alfredo and I to then dedicate more time to the second store because we knew the first store had a team. And so that said, perhaps, and again, this is very specific to us because we had two founders, we were able to then still split between the two stores. If you were a single founder, it would probably be based on the first thing that I described. You need, before look at expansion, the phrase is, expansion is not limited or dependent on your financial capital. It's not whether you have money to open a second store. Your question should be, do I have the human capital to open the second store? Do I have people with me in my first store that are able to share the load and take on responsibility at both stores so that then you can grow? If you try to be at two places at once, you'll find it's not possible.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
And it's not, so it's not just a numbers game. It's not, do I just have the people? It's, do I have the right people too?
Right.
Okay. That's a good, I'll take that with me. All right, thank you for those answers. I want to get back to your story now. So in 2008, a recession hits, a recession that sends people back into their homes. Car sales go down. Restaurants are kind of struggling to keep people in stores. How did that affect you and La Monarca?
Greatly. We had a store in construction. That second store, during construction, we were at 100% in a shopping center that was 100% leased. Uh-huh. And by the time we opened 7-8 months later, the recession was in full force and it was 50% vacant. 50% of the business had shut down. So it was a very testing time, not only for what the idea was and the La Monarca, will this continue, will this persevere, but for Alfredo and I as new recent entrepreneurs to weather a storm for the first time and doing things that were coming at us very quickly as sales weren't there because our initial projection, we had to cut that in half. Okay, you're going to cut that in half, but then how are you going to keep the team, not just employed, but looking at what's going forward, looking not backwards and saying, oh, this all happened and this is terrible, and having a mindset that then becomes doom and gloom. But yeah, hey, this will pass. We need to focus on what's next. But at the same time, we need to be very disciplined. So we learn to be very efficient. We continue manning the registers. Alfredo and I were there all the time to keep costs in order. And of course, you had to adapt quickly to what was happening. In the first year, we survived, and I say survived, more because, again, we had also the team, and they knew what was at stake. They had come with us from Huntington Park, and they had seen that we had a good thing going, and the mission that we had of, again, they had moved up with the company, and they didn't want to see that go. So we were all in it together. So it becomes a team effort. No, it's not one person going to come up with the bright idea.
And when do you start seeing the light after that very dark tunnel?
It took a couple years. It was a longer for everybody. I mean, and some businesses, huge companies didn't make it. And so we were fortunate enough that we were able to. But it took at least a couple years. 09, 10, we're tight.
And then, so after that storm, you start doing, you know, getting better business again. And by 2014, you have five locations around?
I think so. We had maybe just opened the fifth store. Okay.
So you mentioned earlier that you go in with a plan of like what you think is going to sell. What was selling? Like what at that point, if you remember, like what were people buying at La Monarca? What were they stopping by for?
Sure. No, so the pan dulce, for sure, people gravitated towards that. But so within the pan dulce, and we're making everything from scratch. And we said La Monarca is going to be a place where we're going to be innovating with Mexican flavors in different ways. And that's been one of the key product development ideas for us. So flavors, dulce de leche, guava. No, so you hear of these flavors, but then how do you innovate with them? No? And so, yes, you could just put dulce de leche on the classic empanada, dulce de leche empanada. Okay. Well, let's look a little bit more about that. We're doing a croissant dough. We're doing a puff pastry dough. What do we do with that? Oh, so we make a dulce de leche filled croissant, and then we do a dulce de leche filled puff pastry, but we're making cakes. Why don't we do a dulce de leche cake? We do a dulce de leche cake. Or we're doing coffee. How about a dulce de leche latte? And so all of a sudden, La Monarca becomes this place that people come to try these flavors, but in unexpected ways, in ways that are they're not used to. But again, sound good, hopefully. And then, so the cakes very quickly also become something that we're known for. And again, a cake from scratch tastes very different than the little one in the box and just water. So people start noticing that. And we do our cream from scratch. It's not the topping that you buy in the container. And so, again, people start seeing that. We become very well known for our cakes. Yeah. And so over time, coffee has become as initially, we started without coffee.
When did you add coffee?
We added coffee probably 6 months after opening, when people started coming in and everyone had a cup of coffee from somewhere else. And they were asking, why didn't you put coffee? Oh, oops. Because we were doing it like in Mexico at the time. Mexican bakeries didn't have coffee. But so then coffee has become something that also is very emblematic. Our café de olla, it's a signature beverage now that people associate with La Monarca now. Again, different things that you learn or you find out along the way. We didn't think that initially that was going to be, one of the things that would set the company apart. But so we're still very driven by food as bakery, as you well described. But the coffee part has become very also ingrained with people, and our Mexican chocolate. And that's also something we developed once we had the beverages. Okay, what's Mexican beverages that we should have? Uh-huh. So, again, that's where the café de olla, Mexican chocolate. So, again, very tied to our mission, the sweet flavor of Mexico. We are very focused in what we do. We try not to do too many things. We try to stay within our specialty, and how do we get creative with the Mexican flavors?
While still having those traditional staples, you know, you'll still always find a concha at La Monarca. So this menu innovation seems to pay off, and things can only pay off so much for anyone, and only so many things can compete with a global, with a pandemic. So 2020 comes. How do you weather that? I mean, it was what, like a 2+ year storm?
Mm-hmm. Again, it's up to the team to get together. But so again, what is our mission? Mm-hmm. Is it creating opportunities in the communities where we're in? And so this was a time where specifically in many Hispanic neighborhoods that we had stores were not anywhere near a grocery store. Mm-hmm. And so for people to get the basics, we all remember the toilet paper thing, but it was also, oh my God, there's no flour, there's no basic food, there's no milk, there's no eggs. And so we, with our team, say, how do we, yes, we sell food maybe through our suppliers and through the things that we can source. We can support selling staples, and we didn't even mark those up. We just put them at the price that we paid for them. But so that we were able to, again, create the opportunity in our community for people to come and get these basics that they were unable to get anywhere close to them. And again, public transport was out. So again, people, for some folks, this might sound like, really, they couldn't go to a grocery store? Well, some people don't have a vehicle, and the public transport was out. And so what do?
Yeah.
And so that was how we kind of complemented what we were doing. And so I think, and I'm proud of that, because people were very grateful. And I say not just from a customer side, but our employees, because we didn't want to lay anyone off.
But how did you manage financially, though? Because I imagine it's such a hit. Like, did you have some buffer? Were there, like, PPP loans? Did that help? The numbers, how do you make them add up?
No, we applied for PPP. And again, this is where you have to react quickly.
Uh-huh.
And the part with the team to say, hey, this is not business as usual, and this looks like it's going to be for a long time. So becoming efficient in the costs very, very quickly. Then what was the government? They didn't have that immediately. It took a few months. So you have to see, and we've always been very disciplined with our finances. Like I said, the growth is not because you have the money to open the store, but because you have the people. And then we never like to run with a low buffer, with a low. So we had a little bit to withstand, but then we very, very quickly applied to the PPP program. And so the good news there, the government stepped in fairly quickly, which many businesses would have gone on there had they not.
So now I want to get to happier news. So in 2023, this major store calls Costco. How does that come about? And what do they tell you, and what products do they want of yours?
Sure. So it's one of those moments where you have to pinch yourself a little, but then and then you have to very quickly go, okay, how are we actually going to do this? So because we have stores in different neighborhoods, one of Costco's buyers lived, I won't say the neighborhood to not call him out, but he lived by one of our stores, and he was a customer. And then they were looking for more Mexican products, Hispanic products, and so he reached out, hey, I like your stores, I like your products, would you consider selling these to Costco? So of course we then meet with them, and then we learn Costco's, how they operate. They buy very, very large quantities. and Costco's unique in that they do a great job of scouring in the world to find products, like all over the world. So they're very good at finding unique items. But then you have to work alongside their team to make it very custom to Costco. So it had to be brand new packaging, not in the look or colors, but the size. Mm-hmm. And then we'd never done product in that quantity, you know, truckloads. And so that was, it put our, again, our team to work. And we were fortunate that we had already invested in our factory, our central commissary, that we had to supply our own stores, mm-hmm. but that we could use for larger customers. Like, so again, it's serendipity in a way, but we had been building to that moment just on the growth on our own stores that, hey, by that point, when Costco comes knocking, we have this place, a factory that we could actually produce these items. So it then was a very interesting experience, because the first year, mm-hmm. Costco tries a few of their warehouses. So uh-huh. they don't say you're going to be in all of them.
Okay.
You're a new vendor. So they say, okay, La Monarca, you do well in LA. We're going to put you in 14 of our LA region warehouses.
Which is still really good.
Which is good. And thank God, because if you go to it, all of them would have been very, very, a lot of product. But so fortunately, we do well. People like the product. We get really, really good response from just, not just from the Costco customers, but even from our own customers. That, so they become happy to see us there, no? Mm. And so that was in 2022, our first with Costco. And then from there, we were also, the folks from Albertsons saw what we were doing and liked the items as well. And so they asked us if we would go in with them. And so we went in with Albertsons, Vaughn's, Safeway, and Pavilion stores with our cookies, our Café de Olla, initially, and again, Albertsons to test it in some stores. But now they've expanded it to both Southern and Northern California. Costco this year, mm-hmm. after that test, because we did well in LA, other regions called, and so we shipped product last year, 23, to 9 states.
Wow.
So our Café de Olla, our wedding cookies, our Mexican hot chocolate mix. And so that's been a real thrill and very gratifying to see other states where we didn't have, we still don't have stores. We're able to reach them through our products in that way. And then we get people writing us, oh, I tried your product. I went in. I saw you have stores. I'm actually going to be with my family in LA for Disney. And then next month, I'll stop by your store. So we start getting this nice feedback from people in different parts of the country.
Yeah. So one thing I really like about La Monarca is that you pay respects to your namesake, the monarch butterfly. And the way you do that is that you give 1% of your profits to a nonprofit called EcoLife Conservation. Tell me about that.
Yes. And we donate 1% of the sales of all our packaged products. Uh-huh. And so the stuff at Albertsons, World Market, Costco, Amazon, and our so. EcoLife, the founder of EcoLife, Bill Toon, I met back in around 2009, maybe. Mm-hmm. We had just opened our second store about that, 2010. And I saw him on the CBS Evening News live from the Monarch Reserve in Michoacán, Mexico.
Okay.
And he was talking about EcoLife and the projects they did to preserve and protect the monarchs, very specifically planting trees and building fuel-efficient stoves for the people that live around the sanctuary. So I thought that was very practical.
Mm-hmm.
And again, part of our mission from the beginning, the last part, caring for our environment. And we had looked to partner with a group from the beginning to support kind of the monarch butterfly in some way directly in Mexico, but we had been unsuccessful. And so I see Bill, again, Evening News on a Sunday, and I Google EcoLife Conservation, see the number, and cold call their office on Monday.
Okay.
And we've been working together since. So it's been a long partnership. And again, it's about what kind of purpose does your company have?
Uh-huh.
And for the cultural side of not just because of how we see business, say Alfredo and myself. Yes, it's about having a good business, but it's about the opportunities for others,
yeah.
and about hopefully bringing some of your abilities and maybe scale at some point to a social cause as well. So the monarch butterfly, very emblematic. And the main tie-in of what the projects at Ecolife does is really there, yes, to protect and preserve the monarch butterfly, but to help the people that live in Michoacán. Mm. So these are people that still cook on an open fire indoors, which is like smoking three packs of cigarettes every day. And to keep that fire going, they have to keep putting wood, because you don't light a fire and then put it out and then light it the next day. You just keep throwing a little piece of wood on it. So the average family that lives around there chops down 70 trees.
Wow.
Just to keep the fire going. So it was very pragmatic to do fuel-efficient stoves that are culturally appropriate. Mm-hmm. And we could talk about it a lot, but that's it. The main thing is it's still a wood-fired fuel stove, but now instead of having to chop 70 trees, they only have to chop somewhere around 25.
Oh, wow.
So they reduce dramatically the number of trees, and then it's a vented stove, so there's no more indoor smoke, which is the leading cause of death of people in those areas. No pulmonary illness. So it's really great, and we're able to help across borders.
Yeah.
So it's very gratifying.
Yeah, and it's a cycle. No, if you help the family, you're helping the environment. And
right.
I didn't know that statistic. That's a lot.
Yes.
All right. Well, I want to end with what we call Business 101, which is some signature questions we have, kind of more rapid fire. You don't have to answer them too fast. You can take your time if you'd like. So my first question is, what is your earliest money memory?
Selling little chili powder candies that my mom and I recruited my mom to make when I was like in fifth grade in elementary school.
Why did you recruit her? Just because?
Because I couldn't pay anybody. So I was a kid that wanted to sell chili powder candies. And then I told my mom, can you help me? And we would bag these little chili powder with sugar candy. We did a recipe and I was selling it at school.
Oh, look at that.
That was my first entrepreneurial venture.
And kind of full circle, because didn't you just have these special drinks at La Monarca last summer?
That's right.
With the chili?
Yes, yes.
There you go.
Very good, Fernando.
I know my menu. If you had a business school course, what would it be called? So Ricardo 101, colon?
Let's say probably something to branding with purpose.
Oh, I like that.
Something like that.
What is the worst business advice you've ever received?
Don't do it. And I say that in that there's always going to be well-intentioned individuals. So I'm not saying the good advice is just do it blindly. But for trying to create something from scratch, there's always going to be obstacles. There's going to be difficulties. And a lot of people, well-intentioned people, tend to focus on those and bring those to your attention. But it's going to be very difficult to do X, Y, and Z. I don't think you should do it. And so in the end, if that was the mindset, nothing would get done. Mm-hmm. But I don't say that it's necessarily bad advice when someone tells you don't do this, but let me tell you why, and they know what they're talking about. But so As someone that wants to create something, whether it's a business or a play or whatever, you know, if you're just listening to people that keep telling you don't do it, but there's nothing there to back that up other than just fear, that's not good advice.
What's the best advice you've received?
I think the purpose part, getting not only behind the work of developing what the business will be, but what your purpose will be. Okay. And your purpose as an individual and as a company. I think that's that advice I try to then pass on, because it really crystallizes what you're in it for and what satisfaction you will derive out of it.
Hey, thank you so much, Ricardo, for coming by Business School. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Fernando.
Hey, it's Fernando.
If you like this episode, go back and subscribe to get notified when new episodes drop. And if you really, really like the episode, make sure to leave a review. It helps others find the most affordable business school out there right now, Business School. Thanks for listening.